Hello everyone, it's Dave Lynn, and I'm joined today by John Jenkins, and we are your editors of the Corporate Counsel newsletter, and we're here today to talk about the July-August issue, which is now out, and it talks about a variety of topics, and the first one of which is the latest round of SEC rulemaking activity, which includes both a new proposed rule and a final rule, which goes back and changes things about a recently adopted rule. So, John, maybe walk us through what the heck is going on there.
Sure thing, Dave. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the Securities and Exchange Commission for once again issuing a big release just as we were supposed to go to press with our issue. They have an uncanny ability to do that, and they outdid themselves again this time with these proposals. But in any event, 2 years ago, the SEC put in a regulatory scheme for proxy advisors, for ISS and Glass Lewis and the gang, and everyone on the receiving end of those regulations squealed pretty loudly about how it was damaging their business model and all this type of stuff. Well, very quickly, the regime has changed at the SEC, and kind of the most critical component of that rulemaking for companies was repealed really before it had a chance to go into effect. And that's kind of what we talk about in our lead article this month. When the SEC adopted these rule changes in 2020, one of the key things they did was they said that if you furnish proxy advice for a fee, well, that's a solicitation. And that means that if you don't have an exemption, you have all the requirements that apply to anybody else when they solicit proxies at a public company, including filing proxy materials, et cetera. Well, obviously, that doesn't really work if you are out there giving proxy advice on thousands of companies to try and make you file a proxy statement. So the SEC built in an exemption for proxy advisors. In order to rely on it, though, they had to comply with a couple of conditions. And these were laid out in Rule 14A2, B9-1 and B9-2. The first of that, B9-1, requires a proxy advisor to provide some conflict of interest disclosures along with its advice. And then Rule 14A2B9-2 says you have to make your voting advice available to the company no later than the time you disseminate it, and you have to make clients aware of any written statements concerning that advice that the company has in a timely fashion. Well, the new amendments essentially repeal that part. The conflict of interest disclosure is still there, but the simultaneous disclosure to issuers is no longer required. Now, I think as the threat of regulation came to pass on the proxy advisors, they started to kind of clean up their act a little bit and get a little bit better about providing information to issuers and that type of thing. And the SEC pointed to that and when it decided to repeal these rules. But generally, the big reason behind it, according to the SEC's release here, was that their thinking well had evolved based on the concerns expressed by these advisory businesses. Your mileage may vary on whether you buy that explanation or not. I think a lot of people just simply think it's regime change and they're more sympathetic to these, pro-investor, as they see them, voices out there. And we discussed the SEC's reasoning for that, and one of the things they noted was that the other aspects of these 2020 amendments remain in effect, including the fact that this is a solicitation, and there is potential liability under Rule 14A9 for false or misleading statements or omissions that are made in connection with the advice. This, once again, divided the SEC, Commissioner Peirce and Uyeda, who just joined the commission, and this was his first formal action, I believe. They both dissented and issued dissenting statements, and really what they said, basically it boils down to, we just did this, and it doesn't enhance our credibility to undo this so quickly after rulemaking has been put into place. And that wasn't the only thing that the SEC did. At the same time, they issued some proposed amendments to Rule 14A8. And what these will do is modify the basis for excluding proposals under the substantial implementation, duplication, and resubmission standards that are laid out in 14A, I-10 through I-12. Currently, under the substantial implementation criteria, the company has the ability to exclude a proposal if it's already been substantially implemented. Well, the commission is basically proposing to get a little more granular on what exactly that means and to basically say that you have to have already implemented the essential elements of that proposal in order to be able to exclude it on that basis. They say that's going to make it a clearer and more consistent standard and more predictable determinations. What I think a lot of critics are saying is, well, no, it just means we're going to fight about what the essential elements that are, and it's going to be as difficult as always. But I think it's clearly, and I think you see this with the other changes we'll discuss briefly here in a minute, it's a proponent move. I mean, they are making this easier for and more difficult for companies to exclude proposals on the grounds that are laid out in here and make it easier for proponents to include their proposals. Same kind of thing with the substantial duplication requirement. Typically, companies are able to exclude proposals that substantially duplicate another proposal that was previously submitted that's going to be included in the proxy materials. Well, what the SEC is now proposing to do is say, well, yeah, you can only do that on substantial duplication grounds if that proposal addresses the same subject matter and seeks the same objective by the same means. So essentially, it's not substantial duplication. It's almost, total duplication that the standard goes by. Then there's the resubmission standards. A company can exclude a proposal if it addresses the same subject matter as a proposal that was previously included within the past five calendar years, but didn't get the required level of support. It was voted on at least once in the last 3 years. They're switching around that from saying substantially the same subject matter to substantially duplicates standard that was proposed to be included in 14A8 I-10. So essentially, it's going to almost have to be an identical proposal in order for the company to be able to exclude it on these grounds. In addition to these rule proposals, the SEC reaffirmed its guidance on 14A8I7, ordinary business exclusion, that it set forth about 25 years ago, 1998. And I think the most notable aspect of that guidance is that proposals that focus on significant social policy issues generally can't be excluded, even if they do relate to ordinary business matters. And that was something I think that the staff made pretty clear with the staff legal bulletin 14L that was issued last year. Commissioner Person Ida again dissented from this proposal, and they basically said this isn't clarification, this is expansion, and making it easier for proponents to put submissions in and end up in companies' proxy statements. So we'll see how it plays out. These proposals may not be as consequential as the issuance of Staff Legal Bulletin 14L, which was kind of open the gates to wide-ranging ESG proposals, but it's clearly another tilt in the playing field in favor of proponents, and it's going to raise a number of additional proposals in companies' proxy statements. So we'll see how the proposals play out and the comments play out, but it certainly sounds like trending in the direction of making it easier for proponents to get their proposals in companies' proxy statements in the upcoming years. Anything you want to add to that, Dave? Now that I'm taking a breath.
I think when the proxy advisory firm rule changes, this topic is just the ultimate sort of political football, right? It's not something that we would not foresee happening when the political winds shift, and then now obviously the commission is much more attuned to the issues of the institutional investors and the proxy advisors that serve them. I think I'm disappointed a little bit because this issue has been around for a long, long time. It was sort of addressed first comprehensively in the proxy plumbing concept release back in 2010, and it was somewhat encouraging in 2019-2020 timeframe when the commission sort of took it up as an issue to address and tried to formulate some what I think were fairly middle-of-the-road type of rules to deal with the concerns that were described way back when in 2010. Yeah, so it is disappointing, and I tend to agree with the commissioners who expressed the fact that it sort of calls into question the commission's actions a little bit when they duly adopt the role just 2 years ago, roughly, and then turn around and completely revisit that. And notwithstanding the fact that my SEC mentor, Shelley Parrott, always used to say we always deserve the right to get smarter, I'm just not sure that that is the best explanation the commission could have given in the adopting release for that one. And then I think on the proposals for 14A8, to me, I was surprised that they didn't go further, that the commission did not consider a broader range of Rule 14A amendments. These were all sort of interrelated in a way in the approach. And just given the number of interpretive issues that exist today with respect to the substantive basis for exclusion in 14A8, I would have thought they would have tried to address a more comprehensive list of those substantive bases. And interestingly enough, they didn't revisit the recent changes on the procedural side, including the changes to the submission
thresholds. Yeah.
Right. So I guess that's where we leave it, and we'll see what happens next. The other topic I thought that was interesting in this latest issue is just an update on forward-looking statements law, and there have been a number of developments there that John, or you highlighted in an excellent piece on that topic.
Yeah, it's interesting to take a look. Obviously, everybody knows forward-looking statement safe harbor is, it's been around for a long time now. I think people use it. I think people acknowledge that it's imperfect. It doesn't apply to SEC enforcement proceedings. It doesn't apply to state law fiduciary duty disclosure claims, which is a big and growing area. But it's certainly helpful to have there. The SEC can be a little mercurial about it in terms of, when they want you to come forward with forward-looking statements, they're very encouraging and say, even though it doesn't apply to us, we certainly aren't going to second-guess you here. But then sometimes, as in the recent SPAC stuff, they said, oh, no, you've got it all wrong. Everybody who's been doing this for the last several years, it doesn't apply to SPAC transactions the way you think it does. Clearly, the most important folks out there are the courts, because that's really where the rubber hits the road. And if you look at these cases, there are recurring issues that come up over and over again. And even after more than 25 years of this interpretation, you still have courts struggling with the fact that the way the statute is written in the disjunctive, you can have a protected forward-looking statement that may be knowingly false if it's accompanied by meaningful cautionary statements. And the courts have really struggled with that. I mean, they find the idea offensive. It is a certain level, and I get that, but again, Congress kind of knew what it was doing when it put that in place, because it really wanted to encourage forward-looking information. The circuits that have addressed it all seem to have gotten it right. So yes, it is disjunctive, and yes, there is this license to lie element that's kind of baked into the statute. Lower courts have struggled more with that, and we talk about some of the ways they've worked around the safe harbor when they're not comfortable with its disjunctive nature and in this, and then you've seen that in some recent cases. There's a lot of hair splitting that goes on. Well, they'll protect one aspect of disclosure as forward-looking, for example, financial projections, but statements of value that are based on those projections, well, those might be another story. Those may not be protected by the safe harbor. And there's been some recent litigation that we talk about in this article that kind of goes through that. One of the interesting things also is hypothetical risk factors. Obviously, we've talked about this, Dave. I think you've written about it in recent issues of the Corporate Counsel, and everybody understands the SEC's concerns about this. That as one case once put it, to warn about something that hasn't happened is prudent. To warn about something that has happened is fraught. But one of the things I don't think folks have focused on is that there are implications for hypothetical risk factors for forward-looking statements. If you try and point to that as a cautionary statement, the courts in recent cases have said, you know, it's not meaningful because it contradicted your actual knowledge. So be mindful that is out there as well. It's not all negative news. I think one of the interesting case law developments in the last couple of years has been how courts have looked at the safe harbor's application to omissions. Sometimes what happens is a company will make a forward-looking statement that will be accompanied by meaningful cautionary statements, and a plaintiff will go in and say, well, yes, but it was misleading because they didn't go on to say X, Y, and Z in that forward-looking statement. And the courts have not taken the bait on that. They have basically said, if this is an entirely forward-looking statement that you're talking about here, and it's accompanied by adequate cautionary language, you don't have to keep adding additional forward-looking statements that might otherwise be necessary to make it not misleading. It's protected by the safe harbor. So, and again, there's several cases looking at that. One of the other things that is the I think one of the more interesting problems that companies face with forward-looking statements and really the we're on track problem. I mean, a company will make a statement about how things are going or what they expect for the year, and then, in a quarterly setting, they'll be asked if that still holds, and they will say, we're on track. Well, that's a very loaded statement. Tesla, which I think is trying to do its best to give full employment to all M&A lawyers and security lawyers in the country and commentators as well, and they're doing a heck of a job with that. They had a case in the Ninth Circuit where that was exactly at issue. And one of the interesting things they said there was, if you're just saying it's on track again, there's no new information there. So there's nothing that would impeach your prior statement. So you're actually better off, according to the Tesla court, perhaps being a little bit less forthcoming when you're updating, rather than trying to say we're on track because X, Y, and Z. That because X, Y, and Z, that's subject to attack, and the Ninth Circuit was unwilling to just allow the simple updating statement that we're on track to serve as a opportunity to cut through the safe harbor. So, and those are kind of the cases that we're looking at here over the past couple of years. We've got some lessons from them that we try and lay out here for folks to consider, and we'll let the article speak for itself on that front. But it's an interesting topic, and I think it's one that you're going to continue to see very complex decisions rendered on it in the upcoming years.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting topic and very important, I think, to stay on top of these case law developments, particularly in the environment we're in, where I do think people find themselves having to make more and more forward-looking statements just given the levels of uncertainty that they have to deal with in the economy and in the business environment and the like. So it's definitely something that's worth taking a look at in this issue. And last but not least, a topic that I think is always a really important one to delve into from time to time, and that is auditor independence. And if anybody has ever been through a situation with a public company where an auditor is found to no longer be independent and you have to go out and find new auditors and re-audit prior financial statements, it is an extremely painful and costly and damaging process for a public company. And for this reason, I think it's always really important for counselors to public companies to pay a lot of attention to auditor independence advice that comes out of the SEC and the PCAOB, and that's really what we captured in this latest piece.
Yeah, and I think what really prompted us to write it was you've got two statements from the acting chief accountant on auditor independence issues in less than a year. And you also have media reports about the Division of Enforcement looking into auditor independent issues, focusing on non-audit services. So you have two statements and an enforcement push right now on this. So what more do you need? This is on the front burner, and you need to pay attention to what's being said in here, and you need to act on it. The two statements, there's one in October and one that was made in June of this year. And they really, I mean, they focus very heavily on audit, on non-audit services, the role that the audit committee, they view a responsibility for audit independence to be a shared one between the audit committee and the audit firm itself. They talk about the importance of monitoring the audit firm, particularly in situations where there are a lot of non-audit services around. If you have one of the examples that they cite are companies that are very acquisitive and have a bunch of non-audit services, and you know, you can very much catch yourself sideways if you end up with you know, an auditor who's doing services for one party involved in the transaction, and the implications for that, those non-audit services on independence issues for the other party in the transaction get very complicated very fast. So that's something they talk about in some detail in both statements, and non-audit services. The other thing that they focus on in the more recent of the two statements is really kind of directly on the independent standards themselves. And they're in Rule 201 of SX, and the general standard is laid out in 201B, and it basically says the SEC is not going to recognize an accountant as independent if it's not, or a reasonable investor would conclude that it's not capable of exercising objective and impartial judgments on all the issues that are encompassed within the engagement. And the SEC says this is very much a facts and circumstances test. This is the cornerstone of the independence rules. And very interestingly, they say, you know, don't throw precedent up in our face on this stuff, because we are looking at this. Every situation is unique, and we are looking at the facts and circumstances of it. When you interact with OCA on this, that's what they're looking at. The fact that they signed off on something in 2005 and is in the collective memory of the audit firm and will be dragged out as a response to a concern, that's not necessarily going to carry very much weight. They really want audit committees and auditors to look at everything with a fresh perspective on this. The other thing is they're very concerned about the general approach that they think some companies and audit firms take to independence determinations. In addition to 201B, 201C, there's a laundry list, a non-exclusive list of services that an auditor can't provide and still be regarded as independent. That's a non-exclusive list, but the SEC is concerned that a lot of people, a lot of companies take sort of a check-the-box approach to that. And, you know, if you're not doing one of the things on that list, then that's pretty much the, you know, all we really need to be concerned about. What they're emphatically saying is that's not the way it is. And we expect more from audit committees and from auditors on that. They're also very concerned about the evolving nature of the accounting profession and the accounting firms. They know new business structures where they're separating out accounting from other businesses and having non-accounting investors come into the situation. And obviously, Dave, as you're aware, I think many of our listeners are as well, you've got some of the big four firms looking at splitting off their consulting businesses yet again, once every 20 years like clockwork. But that's something I think that the SEC is saying they're going to take a very, very hard look at the implications of that as well. So, you know, we think that clearly this is a time for taking a hard look at your procedures for monitoring audit independence, working closely and collaboratively with your audit firms to make sure that you've got appropriate monitoring processes in place, review your compliance procedures, and make sure you're not taking a checklist approach to this, particularly if you've got a auditor out there that's providing a lot of non-audit services for you. You know, the SEC has never said, you know, that a bright line as to how much is too much. Investors have their own policies. You know, they usually kind of add up the mass of non-audit services and other services, and if they exceed the audit and audit-related services, then you've got a problem, and you may get a negative recommendation from ISS or an investor on their own. But the SEC's never really said they buy into that, and I think very much they're going to be looking at the facts and circumstances of each situation. So ultimately, in this environment, I think that the most important thing that the audit committee should be doing is stressing in their communications with auditors and company management the importance that they place on auditor independence and their desire to avoid close calls, because I think those close calls in this environment are likely to get subject to a lot of second guessing by the SEC and the PCAOB. So tone at the top matters a lot, and they reinforce that in Chief Accountant's statements, reinforce that once again, that the tone at the top matters a lot in this particular setting.
Yeah, it's all a great point there, and I think it's a great article to read just to come back up to speed on some of these latest developments and really think about that in the context of evaluating auditor independence, because it is just an area fraught with risk these days. And I guess just to wrap up, you know, the other reminder that is included in our issue is to check out our upcoming conferences in October. We will be doing our first annual Practical ESG conference, which we're looking forward to. We'll be doing our usual proxy disclosure and executive compensation conferences. And with all the things that are going on these days at the SEC and elsewhere, it definitely makes sense to check those out and sign up for those as soon as you can.
Absolutely. Hope to see everybody there virtually, and hopefully next year maybe in person once again. But we'll keep our fingers crossed on that.
Thanks for joining me today, and we look forward to talking to you the next time.